Okay, we are just past the 7:30, so I'm going to go ahead now and mute all. And as usual, everybody has the ability to unmute yourself. Please feel free to do so if you have a question or comment. Remute yourself afterwards. And later on this evening, contents of the deck in PDF format, the audio track, and the contents of the chat window will go up on our website, along with all of the other previous Q&A sessions going back to 2020. And welcome all. If we have any new people with us tonight, welcome. We welcome guests at any time at any of our meetings. If you do want to join, I've pasted it into the chat window where you can click on to join up. It's just $20 a year, and or just come to our homepage and click the Join or Renew button at the top of the screen. And we have a bunch of items on the agenda for tonight. Hopefully we'll have time for the last 10 as well, but at any rate, let's plow through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away.
Okay, I think we will indeed have time for questions. So, as usual, if you have any questions that you want answered, you can put them in the chat window, and we'll be monitoring the chat as we go along, so we'll get your questions as and when necessary. Okay, first up, we have a YouTube video suggested by Jeff. This is basically how you can make GIMP, which is the GNU graphic
image manipulation
program, right? GIMP, which is a bit like Photoshop but has a completely different menu structure. So for people who like Photoshop, this is actually a patch that will let you make the menu system look a lot like Photoshop. So the video tells you all about it. It is indeed a basic an add-on to GIMP. It's available for Windows, Linux, and Mac operating system. It's open source, so it's completely free, and it's available from GitHub. So if you use GIMP and you want it to make it look like Photoshop, then this Photo GIMP add-on is possibly the way to go. Give it a try.
I've heard bad things about the about Photoshop and its crazy interface. So if you are not already a Photoshop user, you may not want to do this.
Just stick with the GIMP menu. Yeah, the GIMP menu is perfectly fine. I don't use Photoshop, but I do use GIMP, and I don't have any problems with the user interface. It's a very feature-rich menu, so there's a big learning curve if you want to do a whole bunch of sophisticated things. But there are lots of online help files and tutorials, videos, that kind of thing. So you can find out how to do just about anything through a Google search. And talking about Google, Chris has some information for us on Google Drive.
Yeah, this actually... There we go. Okay, so this link came about from Stuart. He actually posted into the suggestion box, and he had came across this article where somebody claimed that making one change in their Google Drive setting saved them 60 gigabytes of solid-state drive space without deleting any files at all. Now, I'll start off by saying that if it actually saves 60 gigabytes, they are not using just a free Google account, which only gives you 15 gigabytes of space. So they're actually paying a substantial amount extra for the space that they have available. But indeed, if they were using 60 gigs, you might not want to have that much space chewed up on your local hard drive. This is really only relevant if you actually install the Google Drive for desktop. And if you only use the Google Drive through the web interface, there's not going to make any difference for you whatsoever. So if you have installed the Google Drive for desktop, which is a free app available from Google, and you can still access all your files on the web through drive.google.com, and you sign in using your Google account and all your files will be there, but you can also access all your files from your local file system using any file manager of your choice. So there are two modes of operation once you install Google Drive for desktop. You can have it either mirror mode or stream mode. So mirror mode what happens is that all of the files that are stored, I'll say all, it's possible to actually do mix and match and not synchronize all of them, but by default, it will be synchronizing all your files between Google Drive in the cloud at drive.google.com and your local system. Any change that you make in one location, either on the cloud or on your local drive, is going to get reflected on the opposite side of things. And that'll be just totally automatic, and usually within seconds, any change will be reflected. In stream mode, the files that are on your Google Drive in the cloud, they only exist in the cloud, with some exceptions I'll get to in just a second. But just the default is that they only exist in the cloud. And you will see them still as if they are on your local system. But the icons that you see on the local system are just placeholders. They're not the actual files. When you try to access the file through that local icon on your computer, the file will get streamed down automatically to your computer in the background. And, of course, depending on the size, it could take anywhere from, you know, a second to, who knows, your speed of your internet connection and the size of the file. It might take a minute for the file to come down or even more. But it does get streamed down automatically, and then it'll just open up locally. So if you make any changes to that file, then those changes, when you save them, they will get reflected back up to the cloud again. Usually within seconds, the synchronization will occur. Now, interestingly, the copy that has been streamed down to your computer will actually remain on your local computer for, quote-unquote, a period of time. It's not defined by Google. It might be around for anywhere from, you know, a couple of hours to a couple of days. Who knows? But it will stick around for a little while. So if you try to access it again within that period, it will access that local file without having to stream it down again. After that period of time elapses, then it will remove the contents of the file from your local system, and then you will have just the copy in the cloud and then that local placeholder where, again, if you try to access it, it'll stream it down to your computer again. Now, this isn't as absolute that it only exists in the cloud. You can actually mark files or folders to change that behavior. So you can right-click on any file and go to the option. There's a available offline option on any of those placeholders. And if you choose that for a file or a folder, it will keep those files permanently on your local storage. So you don't have to stream them down later on. And then if you make any changes again to that local file, it'll get replicated back up to the cloud, but then that local copy will stay there. So that's a really good choice if you want to be able to access files when you don't have an internet access. So because in normal stream mode, it's just a placeholder, the file isn't there. If you click on it, double-click on it to open it up, and you don't have an internet connection, well, you can't do anything with that file. It doesn't exist on your system. So if you want to have those files available, whether you have internet connection or not, you want to mark them as available offline. You can also mark them as online only. And what that will do is if it has already been streamed down and you have a copy that is remaining on your system for that period of time, it will immediately remove that locally cached copy of it. And then in the future, any files that are marked for online only, it'll stream down when you try to access it. Whatever you do, when you close that file, it will immediately remove that local file rather than keeping it around for a period of time. So that's a really good choice if you want to free up as much space as possible on the local drive, because you won't have these cached copies on your drive at all. But again, keep in mind that you do not have access to those files if you don't have an internet connection. So one of the things the person complained about was they were freeing up space on their SSD. By default, in both mirror mode as well as stream mode, the local copies that are streamed down or mirrored to your system will be under C users, your username, and My Drive. So usually if you have multiple drives, your C drive is going to be the fastest SSD. You may have a larger drive available to you that is maybe slower, bigger, things like that. Well, fortunately, you don't have to stick with that as your location. So you can actually configure Google Drive for desktop so that it will use a different location on your system. And so it can be another drive, or it could be just a different folder on your C drive. Whatever you want to choose, you're able to do it. And that's it.
Are you sure? I can see one more slide.
Do you? Oh, sorry. Yeah, you're right. Which is best? So if you're trying to choose between the two of them, mirror mode is really good if you're not concerned about space on your local drive. So you got oodles of space available, and you really want to keep a copy of all your files on the local storage all the time, as well as in the cloud. So if you want the exact same set of files available all the time, whether you're connected to the internet or not, mirror mode is the way to go for sure. Stream mode is when you want to start saving local storage space. And that's really the biggest concern, I think, is just if you don't want to have all of those files taking up space all the time. And then you're not concerned about being able to access the files when you're not connected to the internet. And then keep in mind that in stream mode, you can selectively mark files and folders for offline use. So if there are some of your files that you need to have available all the time, you can mark those ones and let the other ones expire and leave your system as needed. And I guess that's it.
That certainly is it. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, next up we have an item from Harvey on a little utility.
All righty, thanks all. BattleArc Advisor, it's a product that's available from a company name called BattleArc. They're a computer software company in Massachusetts, and they've been around since 1997. But essentially, what the software provides, lets us scan the computer, and it'll give us a report of all your hardware, the installed software, and any of the license keys and security updates if you're lacking any or if you have some gone through. So there are hardware specs, and there's software inventory, and there's security status. There's a whole pile of stuff on the report, but it's very good. I pointed out to Chris that if you were to buy a new computer and you wanted to manage what you want to move over to the new computer from your existing, this report will help you plan that transition. So keep that in mind if you're planning to get another computer. Alrighty, the next slide, please. This is the download link for BattleArc Advisor. Now, in getting that software, they want you to put in your email address, which I don't advise you doing. So just put in your initials and at abc.com, et cetera, et cetera. Submit that, and you'll be able to download the software. And the file name there is advisorinstaller.exe. Next slide. Now, when you go to install it, there's going to be a license agreement, of course. Click install. There's going to be security definitions. That means the Microsoft security items that are being offered to you, they will check to see whether you have it on your computer or not. And then it'll start to create a profile of your computer. When it's complete, it's going to give you an HTML report, and you can save that to your computer for future reference. Next slide. Now, this little square on here is very little information. So, Chris, if you can give me a share screen offer.
Oh, my apologies. Okay.
No problem.
Yeah, just a sec.
All right.
Host, and you should be good to go there now.
Okay, so what I'm going to do, I'm going to open up, if I can find it, here it is. This is the full report, and I'll just go through it quickly. There's a lot of information here, but it gives you your computer name, your Windows login, your operating system information. So, of course, Windows 11, blah, 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 all the rest of it. it'll tell you whether your boot mode is secure. The processor give you all that information. Over here, the system model and serial numbers. Here's your main board on your computer. In my case here, it says UEFI. This just happens to be the BIOS, the current BIOS that is installed. And then it checks the battery and will give you an assessment on the health. And the storage. I have one I have one NVMe drive on the computer, and it's going to show me that. It'll show me what memory is installed. In this case, there's 2 × 8. And if we go further down, this will give you the actual brand and serial numbers and things of your drive. And on the right side here, it will just point out to you that the C drive is the operating system, how much is free, that type of thing. It's also BitLocker. I don't know if you've heard of that. That's the encryption of the drive. And because I'm using a NAS, it's going to show me what drives I have mounted on the NAS. And it will just give me that information. Your local accounts that you're using, printers, etc., etc. Your display, what display adapters you're using there. I shouldn't say that. This says display adapter, but that's your screen. I also use a docking station, D6000. And the virus protection, it'll show you what you're using, and any updates, dates, that type of thing. Now we get further on down here where it says communications. This is where all your network adapters are showing, etc. And of course, I'm connected here on a Realtek wireless, and it gives me my IP addressing, my gateway back out through my Bell modem, that type of thing. And if you plug in a USB drive, it'll record it, what date it went in. And this is where we can show the network map of what you're currently connected to. So this is my Bell modem. And then it shows all the devices connected and the addressing. And if we go further down, if you had missing security updates, it would tell you here. And it would be a good idea to check those out. And this here is where your software licensing will show. So what products you're using, for example, like here, Intuit, I'm using QuickBooks, gives me my licensing and all that type thing. Now, the rest of this information, starting in the left column, A through Z. So this is all the software installed on your computer. So all the way down and then back up here, Microsoft, et cetera, et cetera. I didn't know I had so much junk. But anyway, you can filter that out or have a look at it before you go over to your new computer and figure out what you want to use and move. So this is my suggestion. If you were going to set up a new computer, have a look at what you currently have and maybe plan it out a little better. All righty, that's it.
Thanks, Harvey. It's also really useful because it looks up authorization keys for some of that software too.
That's right, yeah.
And you have one take, and Natalie says she can use it for her transition to a new computer.
Yeah.
Harvey?
Yes.
If you post that as part of the other stuff that's posted tonight, remove your license key from your Windows. Blank it out.
We're not posting that, Tim.
Okay.
That was a live demo, so.
Oh, all right.
That won't go to the website. Okay, thank you very much, Harvey.
You're welcome.
Next up, I have another YouTube video. This is Dave Plummer, the Microsoft guy, and Dave's Garage. And one of his recent videos on YouTube is how to he explained the Ethernet. Now, I'll point out this is really, really technical, but it does kind of fill in the blanks. If you really want to know how information gets from one computer to another over the Internet, using Ethernet, he explains it in a lot of detail. And you might have to watch the video a couple of times, but there's a lot of information there, and I think he does a really good job trying to explain it. Okay, next up, Stuart comes up with some oddball items from time to time. Sometimes. this one is actually quite useful if you're traveling, I think. It's basically an application that tries to find public washrooms. It's a bit like GasBuddy for gas stations. It's user-sourced information. But the app is available for your phones, iOS and Android. And there's a free version, which I guess does what you need. I don't know what you get for the $3 if you buy the paid version. But basically, people can long press on a map and input information about a new location that's available. They can add information about handicap access and whether there's a fee involved. In Europe, sometimes you have to pay, for example. There's the two URLs, so if you have any interest in that type of application for your hands-on device, then download it and give it a whirl. Chris, next up is yours.
Yes, this is an article I came across, and I will preface it by saying that I sort of agree with them, but not quite as vehemently as Chris does in this one. So Chris Hoffman, he wrote this PC Mag article, and he had a test computer that he had took a fairly powerful computer, so an AMD Ryzen 9 CPU, which is quite capable, and a very speedy SSD, and he crippled it so that it looked like it had 8 gigs of RAM. And then he started playing around with it to see what's the effect of trying to run Windows 11 with only 8 gigs of RAM. And he said it used 6.6 gigabytes of RAM on a fresh boot with very few startup applications. Now, I will add a comment to that part of it, too, in that Windows itself will use an awful lot of RAM that it doesn't necessarily need to use. And it will use it for things like caching and other operations that will speed up things. I mean, why not use the RAM to make Windows faster? But it can give up a lot of that RAM if it needs to for when you start loading other applications. So just the fact that it's using 6.6 gigabytes of RAM is not necessarily a shocking thing. But then he started to notice that Windows was shuffling data back and forth between RAM and the solid-state drive as storage as he switched between apps. And that's the memory manager that is coming into play. And the way the memory manager works very broadly is that if a program wants RAM, you know, when you load something, Windows doesn't say, oh, I'll give you 2 gigabytes of RAM or I'll give you 4 gigabytes of RAM or whatever. The program requests a certain amount of RAM, and Windows basically says, sure, I'll give you that. And if it has got a whole bunch of memory that is already in use by other applications, it'll copy those or move those applications out to disk and then free up that RAM so that you can run your other application. And then later on, if you try to access that other program that got shuffled off to disk, something else will get shuffled off to disk, and then that program will get reloaded into RAM. So that's a very, very slow operation. So once it starts swapping like that, that will slow down your computer considerably. So Chris's recommendation is that don't settle for an 8 gigabyte RAM computer. So he thinks that you shouldn't settle for anything less than 16 gigabytes. It used to be quite standard that 16 gigabytes was really the norm. And with the cost of RAM going up, you're starting to see more and more computers out there that do have only 8 gigs of RAM instead of the 16 gigs in order to come in at a price point that people are going to be able to afford, I guess, is the idea behind it. So we are seeing more and more computers that are coming out with 8 gigs of RAM rather than 16 gigs of RAM, and Chris is of the opinion that you shouldn't buy those. You know, insist on getting at least 16 gigs. I say that there is a place for 8 gig RAM computers, but only if it's really light use. So, and I see that Tom says, or move to Linux. Yeah, I mean, other operating systems, certainly Linux can use a lot less RAM. So I think it is important to consider it, you know, the 16 gigs versus an 8 gig, especially because of the fact that so many more new computers are coming out with 8 gigs of RAM. Really take a look at it and see whether you think that's appropriate for your particular use or not. So not a bad article. So take a look at that. I pasted that into the chat.
Next up is yours,
too. Next is mine, yes. So how everything works. This is a kind of interesting thing I came across. And it's an email newsletter. Let me just paste this into the chat. So it's a free newsletter that comes out daily. And it answers all kinds of weird, wonderful questions. And it's not really all that very computer-related, but I threw it in here because, well, it gets delivered to your email mailbox, so it's sort of computer-related. But most of the questions are really not computer-related. But if you look at some of these samples, I mean, these are questions that, you know, you might not have thought about to ask even, or you might have thought about and wondered, really it is, you know, why do we need water? You know, what happens when you hold in a sneeze? And they talk about physiologically, you know, what happens to your body when you do that? Is it good or bad? Why can't you hear yourself snore? That's an interesting one. People who snore really loudly, they disturbs everybody else's sleep, doesn't disturb their sleep. You know, I didn't know that goats had rectangular pupils. You know, all these sort of things that I thought it was kind of cool. And there's a lot of repetition in it, so they usually have one main question, and then they'll have a whole bunch of other questions that are quasi-related to the main question. And a lot of them end up getting repeated, but it seems like every day there's at least one that is brand new that they're bringing forward. I thought it was kind of fun. Check it out, and you can always unsubscribe if you find it too boring.
And the next one
is mine. Oh, Windows Guide newsletter. Let me just get this copied and paste it in. So this is Chris Hoffman at PC Magazine, and he's been writing about operating systems for many, many years. And he concentrates on Windows, but he also uses Mac OS and Linux. And there's a weekly newsletter that you can get for free. And what they're trying to do is do a deep dive into you know, a more narrowly focused, important story of the week. And so they're not just trying to be the be-all and end-all of everything. It's just what they think is something that really matters, and you know, they dig down into that. I've only seen 2 weeks of it so far, and so far I haven't been overly impressed with it, but I'll keep going with it for a while to see whether they come up with some more interesting information for me in particular. But you can check it out and unsubscribe if you don't like it. That's it.
That is it, indeed it for a while. Thank you very much, Chris.
Yeah.
All right, so next up, we're going to go back to my series on vibe coding. And our monthly meeting is coming up. In September, Chris is going to be talking about artificial intelligence. But in October, we've scheduled a vibe coding competition. So the idea is that people who are interested in developing an application of some kind, a program, a script, a macro, whatever, using vibe coding. So there'll be two parts to the competition. One will be basically looking at the best, the application that people find the most useful. So the most useful, or the best application, I guess, But also, we're going to have a second competition, which is the best presentation of how you develop your app using vibe coding. And one of the ideas for this is that maybe trying to develop your app wasn't terribly successful or incredibly frustrating, and you tore your hair out and gave up in disgust, but you have some kind of anecdotes or funny stories or whatever, and you're going to put a presentation together and tell us how good or bad or indifferent the process was for your vibe coding project. So it doesn't have to be a finished app. It can be a disaster, but you can tell us about it and still be in the running for a prize in our competition. So I'm going to carry on with the application which I've been developing over the last few segments. And this is WMET, which is a PC magazine utility program. And you can see here that it's got two windows. There's a left panel and a right panel. And the left panel is looking at my drive D, which is my data drive. And the right panel is looking at my drive U, which is an external USB flash drive. And what it does is it basically lists the folders and the files which are on these two in these two directories, and it's showing me which are the same and which are different. And if you look down the bottom there, you can see that there's a Python script right here which only exists on the left-hand side. And there's a file here called a database file which comes from FreeFileSync, and it's available on both sides, but they're not the same file. There's a difference between these two files. And the last three files are available in both disks, and they're exactly the same. So if I want to copy just the different ones, I could select these two right here, and then go up here somewhere, and one of these icons is a copy to the right sort of thing. So what I did was I used vibe coding, just told the chatbot what I wanted it to do, and it basically created this program in Python. So it created a Python script, and this is running that Python script. And you can see that I basically replicated it. I've got a couple of different folders here. Here's one on my D drive and one on my U drive. And it's found a couple of files which are only available on the data drive and not available on the backup. So now I've highlighted those, and now I can use this button here to copy those files from the data drive to the backup flash drive. So I basically replicated the program.
Hang on a second there, Alan. We've got a notice that Dave Clark has started screen sharing. Please don't do that, Dave. I'm surprised you were able to. At any rate, see if you can take back control of the screen sharing there, Alan.
Okay, that's a good point. How can I do that? Yeah. Probably like that.
Yep.
See,
we're back.
So we're back to where we were, I think, I hope. So this is my replication, essentially, of at least the basics of this WMAX utility. So if you recall what we did, we went through a series of hoops, and we jumped through all the necessary hoops, and we've established this two-pane folder view. We can select the folders that we want to compare just by double-clicking on them. The rows that indicate the folders and the various files are synchronized between the two disks. It highlights every other row in light blue just for ease of navigation. And then I've got these check marks and arrows which tell me whether files are the same or are newer or whatever. And I can double-click to change directories. I can click on a column, I can sort it by file name or size or date, whatever. I can resize the columns just by dragging them. I can select one file or I can select multiple files, and I can copy the files from one folder to the other. So, and basically that's all I use WMAX for. It has a lot more features, but those are the things that I do. I just use it to look for different files in one folder than the other and copy the old files over to the backup. But the problem is now, of course, it's a Python script. So if you don't have Python, I can't give you my script. Well, I could give you my script, but you then have to load Python and figure out how to use it. But if you remember, way back when, we were asking it, did it know about WMatch and how was it going to do it? And it said that what it could do was it could use a program called PyInstaller to create a Windows installation package, essentially a standalone executable file, an EXE file, and which I could then give you the EXE file, and you could install that or run it or whatever on your system without having to worry about the nuts and bolts of Python. So it basically suggested two things. The first thing we're going to look at is the second option, which is to use a program called InnoSetup, which I'd never heard of prior to this suggestion from the chatbot. But basically it says it will produce a professional setup.exe file, which would be the distribution file. So just looking at this option, here's the website for InnoSetup. And basically it's a free program if you're just using it for home use. You have to buy a license if you use it commercially. And it basically does what it says. If you give it a Python script file, you can give it an icon and some other stuff, it will create an executable file in the distribution folder. And then you would basically release or distribute the EXE file to your friends, relatives, customers, whatever. I didn't actually want to bother installing that because the original thing was to use this program called PyInstaller, which clearly is a program that runs with Python. And since I already have Python installed, I've been developed this Python script, and clearly I can use PyInstaller fairly easily. So let's find out something about PyInstaller, which again, I hadn't heard of until I ran across this in the chatbot. So it says it's going to analyze my script, gather everything it needs to run it, and basically bundle it to produce either an executable file, an EXE file, or a folder which contains everything it needs to run the program and any library files, for example, which are dependencies. So it's going to look at my script. It's going to deal with the Python interpreter. It's going to deal with all the libraries it needs. And Qt is the library that does all the graphic window type stuff, and any data files which don't apply to my particular option. Basically, what we need to do is issue this terminal command here to install the PyInstaller program using pip, which is a Python module. So we're going to install PyInstaller, and then we're going to use another command to run PyInstaller on our script file, and it says that will create a build folder, a distribution folder, a specification folder, and in that distribution folder will be the executable program. And you notice that the executable program is going to have the same name as my Python script by default. We'll deal with that in a minute because it's going to tell us how to do that. So it says what I should do is run PyInstaller with a one file switch, which produces a single executable file. I use the windowed switch, which removes the console window, whatever that does, and then I have to tell it the Python script that I want it to operate on. So it gives me the command to use. And then the exe file, it's going to do all this stuff. So it's going to have a Python runtime. Clearly, if you're running a Python script, you have to have Python somewhere. But it's basically giving you kind of a mini version of Python that built into the executable file, so you don't have to worry about installing Python. It's going to have the actual script, the code of the script. so it can run the WMatch program which we've developed. And then it's got all the libraries, the PySide 6 and the Qt 6. It's got some plugins for various things. And if it needs some dynamic link libraries, DLL files, it will include those too. And it will wrap all of this stuff up into a single .exe file. It says it's going to be 60 to 120 meg because it's got to include all those runtime things. So we might start off with a Python script, which is a few kilobytes, but our runtime is going to be several megabytes. But remember, it's got all that background stuff built into it. We could add an icon if we wanted, an ICO file. I'm not going to bother doing that. But here's a nice one. Give the executable a nicer name. So when we run that PyInstaller command, we give it a name switch and tell it that the name is going to be WMatchClone rather than this script file name. So then the result is going to be in the distribution folder is going to be an executable called WMatchClone.exe, which is a nice tidy thing that we can then distribute to people. So indeed, that's what we're going to distribute, WMatchClone.exe. And Chris can run this on his Windows program. Yay! Lucky you, Chris. But it warns me here that because we're bundling all this stuff into an executable file, then some antivirus programs may kick up a false positive. So if that were to be the case, which it doesn't seem to be, I ran this thing and it worked just fine, I could do some stuff down here to try and give it a signing certificate and make it kind of more legitimate, I guess. Turns out I didn't need to do that. So again, just like that inno setup thing, it tells me it wants the same kind of setup. I only worry about giving it the Python script file. I don't worry about anything else. And here's the build script, which is suggesting, but I'm not going to use this icon thing here. I'm just going to use the rename command. So, going back to our terminal, we've got to do two things. We have to do the pip install PyInstaller to actually install this PyInstaller application. And you can see it does a whole bunch of stuff, and then it tells us down the bottom here, I think, successfully installed. So it has installed PyInstaller. Now we can give it that command, PyInstaller, one file, windowed, name WMatchClone, and the name of the script. And again, it runs a whole bunch of commands here, and eventually it says, build complete, right? So everything seems to have worked, and the results are available in, and then it's available in my WMatchClone folder, in this distribution folder, which PyInstaller created automatically. So if you remember, it said it was going to create, here's my WMatchClone folder. It said it, and these are all the Python scripts that the chatbot developed as we went along. I saved them as different names as we got different versions. But PyInstaller created a build folder, a distribution folder, and this specifications file, which I don't know why I need that, but if you have a look at this build folder, there's a whole bunch of stuff there, which again, I actually don't really need. So if we go to the actual distribution folder, sure enough, we have a single file, an executable, which is called WMatchClone.exe, and this is the program which we can run on Windows. So if I do that, if I actually run that program, you can see that if I look at my D drive and the WMatchClone folder, and I look at my flash drive and look at the same WMatchClone folder, the things that are different are these two directories, the build and the distribution directory. All the Python scripts are the same because they've been backed up previously. And then down the bottom here somewhere off the screen, is that specs file, which again was developed by Pi Installer. If I wanted to, I could copy these over by highlighting them and copy them to the right. So my WMATCH clone program, originally as a Python script, is now an executable program which I can distribute. So the good news is that this is now available. So if you're interested in WMATCHclone.exe, for $19.99 only $19.99, and that's Canadian dollars, you get the shiny logo and the exe file, which will answer all of your copying requirements. But seriously, I'm not really selling that program, honestly. It really was just designed to show you how, even a non-programmer, you didn't have to know anything about Python to develop this application. You just had to go with the flow, talking to the chatbot, correcting it when it screwed things up. And over this series of Vibe coding examples, I've shown you how to develop a simple web page. That was pretty straightforward. I've shown you how to extract text strings from a file, text strings from a text file, and using that to create essentially a macro to do that on an ongoing basis. And now we've done this fairly complicated, I think, file and folder comparison tool. And we even wrapped it up in this nice package where we can distribute an exe file so that anybody could run the program. The Vibe coding stuff, you may have to download some tools. I mean, for example, all of my stuff so far we've developed in Python, but I have done some stuff in C and C++. So you need a Python interpreter to run the code that you develop. Or if you're using C++, then you need a C compiler. So you have to download and install the tools that you need to actually run the code that you're developing. But basically, as I said earlier, you just tell the chatbot what it is you want to do in plain English. And try and make it as specific as you can be and with as much information as you can give it, because that's the best way to get the end product that you really want. It's almost certainly not going to work the first time, and so you give it a second prompt and you say, well, no, I don't want you to do that, I want you to do this, or add this to the process, you know, keep everything the same but now do this as well. And be patient, because chatbots, they're pretty stupid, I think. They make mistakes. They make simple mistakes with simple coding. And they also make the same mistakes as you go along. So sometimes you have to, as I say, you have to drag it back. If it goes off on a tangent, then maybe you say, well, you know, rather than version 6 doesn't work, rather than version 7, develop version 7, go back to version 5 and add this process instead. So you have to be patient, but you also have to be persistent. You're going to get anywhere. You have to browbeat this chatbot into submission. I find that if you want to do something really simple, it's actually a really good technique. You want to do something really complicated, it can be pretty frustrating. So I would suggest you find a task that you want to do repetitively, which is fairly straightforward, and try to use Vibe coding to develop a program, a script, a macro that will do that task for you on a regular basis. So remember, we have this Vibe coding competition coming up in October. So what app or script do you want to produce and tell us the tale of war or the tale of fabulous success when you develop your application? So there you go. That's the end of WMATCH clone, and I'll probably have another couple of examples, but I'll make them fairly simple before the actual competition, just to give you a bit more incentive to go ahead and build something.
Yeah, don't think that you need something as complex as WMatch clone to present at the October meeting. My example is going to be much, much simpler than that, but I have some tales of woe about it as well as successes in my particular example. But yeah, sure, try it out. Look for anything that is a repetitive thing that you can automate. Try it out. Really good. We have a couple of questions or comments. Tom asked, is pip a Linux program?
Yes, it is. It's basically a module which you download and install.
Okay. And Glenn asks, will this executable run any faster than running the original Python script interactively?
That's a good question. It loads almost instantly, so it's really hard to tell. It's not really an application that that takes a long time to load the screen, so I really don't know. It's an interesting question.
Yeah, kind of hard to tell on
I would imagine program it's that runs because quickly. It's, presumably it's compiled. Well, maybe it's not, because they give you a Python runtime.
Yeah.
They interpret it on the fly.
Yeah, it could well be. I wouldn't be surprised if that's the case.
Yeah, but as Tom says, if you want a small and fast program, use C or C++.
David says he thinks that a Washroom script would be a good thing to work on. And just going back a little bit to the Washroom item that we had earlier on, Natalie comments that it's very useful for those with GI issues, and there are others as well, and she pasted into the chat a Go Here app, which I presume is a similar sort of thing, letting you know where washrooms are available. And I think that that's all I've seen in the chat. So, yeah, I think we're at the point now where we are definitely in the last 10. So if anybody has any questions or comments or anything like that, problems you've got, items you want to share with the rest of the group, now is the time to speak up. You can raise your hand if you want, or throw it into chat, or unmute yourself and ask audibly.
Okay, well, while people are thinking, there was a question early on from Diane looking for advice on how to transfer a VHS tape to a digital file so she could use it on her computer and or a memory stick. And my suggestion there was to check out the Ottawa Public Library, because I think it's at Nepean Center Point. They
It's the Beaverbrook branch.
Beaverbrook, then they have a suite of machines that will do various kinds of digital recording. And my recollection is that one of them is transferring VHS to digital files.
Yeah. You can book time on their equipment there, or some of the things you can actually book the equipment to take home with you, which is appropriate when you have things that are going to run for a couple of hours in order to do the transfer, because it might be a real-time type of operation where you have to actually play the VHS tape and have it then take the output and put it into a digital format. So some of the equipment like that, they do allow you to book it, take it home, and do it at your leisure.
If she has a VHS machine, I purchased the VHS to DVD. So you hook the VHS machine up to your computer, and it transfers it to a hard drive or wherever, thumb drive, wherever you want to put it, and then you can burn it on a DVD or just run it off your computer. And if there's only certain sections of that tape you want, you can record 5 minutes, forward it, because those people are no longer married. Forward it, you don't have to record the whole thing, and then you can do it at your leisure. But you need a VCR, obviously, to do it, to play the actual tape.
What's the cost of that, David?
I think this was around $39-$40. I got it at Best Buy.
Yeah. Not bad. Yeah.
So I'm pretty sure Amazon also has it. It's just a it takes your video and your audio out, and it puts it into a USB.
Okay. And what's the name of it again?
It's called Roxio Easy VHS to DVD.
There you go. Thanks very much, David.
I've used something similar called Honest Tech VHS to DVD, which is a similar thing. It's just a little box that connects the VHS recorder to the computer.
Diane, if you were trying to talk, you're muted.
It's still muted, Diane. So I think it was her question, right?
Okay, sorry. So if I get it from the VHS to my computer, can then I then download it from the computer onto a memory stick?
Yes, you can. Or you can burn it on a DVD.
Yeah, well, I want to give gifts to people. This is a, I have an interview with my mother-in-law. Anyway, I want to put it on a memory stick and give it to people.
Yeah, that should be doable. Yeah,
basically what you get is something like an MP4 file. So it's just a file, a digital file.
Okay, and you can download it onto whatever format.
Yeah, whatever format. My wife wanted it because she's got all these tapes of the kids, and she just wanted to make up a thumb drive for each of them. You know,
yeah, it makes a nice Christmas.
She's never done it yet because it's a lot of hours.
And I have another really, you might find this to be a stupid question, but I'm making a children's book. I want it self-published, but it's just for family. And I'm going to have my granddaughters do the illustrations. Because I looked at something on Facebook, now I'm getting inundated with offers on publishing, and I'm at a loss. I don't want to be scammed. Has anybody any experience with that?
I would stay away from Facebook if I was you. No?
Yeah.
What's it called?
No, stay away from Facebook. You will get scammed.
Oh, yeah, I know. I've had at least 10 different companies offer me rates, like from $2.99 to $9.99. And this is just for family. It's kind of for fun.
I could check Diane with my sister because I believe she wrote quite a few young adult books. And she self-published, and it was mostly just for family and then a few.
Yeah.
So I can check with her. I think it was on Amazon, but let me check with her, and I can get back to you if you want, okay?
Yeah, I don't want to spend, like, $1,000.
Oh, no, she
little children's book.
No.
It's really just to involve my granddaughters and make this product and
basically, I bought a few, and it was just whoever bought them, that's when you paid. She didn't have to pay again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it cost me like $8 or $9 for each book. They were about, you know, 80, 90 pages long. They were not less, like for ages 14, 13, 12, somewhere in there. So they weren't super long, but they were full novels. So.
Yeah.
Diane, in the chat, there is a link for that VHS transfer product that Natalie posted, so you could check that out. That's at Best Buy.
Okay, thank you.
Like you said, Harvey, stay away from Facebook.
There was a news article.
Yeah, my wife ordered some books, and yeah, it was a nightmare. Yeah.
There was a news article today about the lady was scammed out of $900,000. You don't get a second chance doing these things, so be very careful.
Natalie has her hand up.
Yeah, just a quick question. So I went to that link, and of course I take everything with a grain of salt, and they were kind of old, but some of the comments were that that product doesn't work with Windows whatever. So just a question for who recommended it? Was it David?
Yeah, David.
Yeah, so have you used it recently with, you know, a current version of Windows?
No.
Okay.
No. I don't have the actual box, but I will look into that. Like, maybe it won't work. Windows 10 is what she has in her computer, so it may not work with Windows 11.
No, this was actually several years ago, and it was saying that it wasn't working with 10.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know if there are more recent reviews elsewhere. That was just from the Best Buy site. So just check into it before you delve into
it. What I have here is version 3.
Okay.
Or David was saying
you're
it's
right.
available.
You're right. It says right on the manual here. Windows 8 is the highest.
Whoa. That's
okay. Forget that, guys. Sorry.
Okay. Well, there's probably similar products around, though. So, check out just do a Google search or something on,
still selling it. Jeez.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy for them to sell a product that only works on 8. But as I say, there's probably similar products around. So if you do a search on it. And I see the other Diane on the call tonight says that she's also interested in the book questions. So actually, Linda, if you would be interested in putting together a slide or two for an update for next week's Q&A.
Sure.
Okay.
If you want to show the slides or if I can wait a week or whatever, but I'll hear back from my sister before then.
So yeah.
Put a slide together.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
We could wait 2 weeks probably on that. So if you wanted to present it 2 weeks out, we'll reserve time for you.
Okay. Well, it's probably going to be pretty minor, so I can just put the slides together and you can run through them.
Some publishers want to have a run of books where you pay for a certain number of books, but other publishers will just create them online, and then if you want one off, they'll print it off and bind
it.
And send it off to you one at a time.
Yeah, that's I believe how Amazon does it. You publish it there, but it doesn't get printed unless somebody orders it. So, Diane, if you were ordering 5 for family, then you would pay for 5.
Okay. Well, that's more or less what I want. I don't expect to get famous.
No.
I just want to, it's more or less to involve my granddaughters doing the illustrations, and the text is pretty simple. It's supposed to be a children's book. But I think they will get a kick out of it, and their name will be in print.
I don't know if the pricing's different for depending how many illustrations you have. My sister, it was a novel. She had an illustrated cover, obviously, but she didn't have any illustrations in the interior. So I'll have to try and get that information.
Okay.
Going back to the transferring of the digital information. We have a comment from Cal saying Windows 10 has compatibility mode option to be able to run Windows 8 apps. So that could potentially be a solution to that fact that the software is designed for Windows 8. But you just have to try that, I guess. Leo has a question. We have a website that was created with Mac-based software. Is there software to convert Mac web pages to Windows-based software or WordPress? I'm really surprised when it's web-based things, web is web. And so I'm really surprised there'd be anything that would be really specific to an operating system on that.
Well, won't it just be an HTML file?
That's what I would have expected, that it just be that. Unless it's something like WordPress that is, a publishing package that was specifically designed to run on Mac. That's the only thing I could think on that. And if that was the case, I would look to see what is that package and try and find whether there's a conversion to export the web content from that package to something else, either plain HTML or WordPress or something like that. If anybody else has any ideas, chime in.
Yeah, Leo says you'll get more information on the package. Do that, Leo, and send it in to the suggestion box, because I'm interested in that question.
Okay.
Okay, so we're 8:34. Any more questions? We'll hold them off till next week, I guess.
Okay, it looks like that's pretty much it for questions. So, yeah, if you have anything in addition, make sure you send it into suggestion box at opcug.ca. And we'll queue it up for next week. And if you have any other ideas for things you wanted to share with the group, send it in to the same address. We'd be happy to put together some slides so that anything that you find interesting, other people may find interesting as well.
Okay, so one of the things you can share is your favorite application, some application that you find really useful. It can be a utility that you use for some task or something that's just fun to use. just a short presentation like Harvey did tonight on that Bellark Advisor, and just tell us how it works and what it does for you, why you like it. Because if you like it, chances are somebody else will find it useful or interesting too. So, again, anything you want to discuss with the group, there's the address for your questions, comments, shares, whatever. And last couple of times I've been talking about the need for articles for the club's newsletter, and Bridget will be going to press within probably the next couple of weeks, I think, so you probably have a couple more weeks to get your material in for the September issue. Anything that's related to computers, short or long articles. Long articles can always be broken up into multiple parts. Anything that's computer related will be gratefully received. And if you're not a member of the group, you can still subscribe to two of our Google groups. OPCUG announcements gives you essentially two emails a week, one on the weekend and one an hour before the meeting, the Q&A session or the monthly meeting will tell you what's going on. Or if you want to get the newsletter as a PDF file delivered to your email, then you need to subscribe to OPCUG newsletter. And only members can subscribe to the member forum. And the member forum, if you're not familiar, it's essentially a 24/7 Q&A forum. So people post questions and interesting items, and you will receive emails telling you what's going on, and you can reply directly to that email and distribute it to the forum recipients. And as usual, next Wednesday, August the 19th, will be our next Q&A session. So as I've been talking about just recently, just now in fact, if you have questions or if you have follow-up on things we've talked about tonight, or if you've got new topics that you'd like to share with the group, just send us an email, give us a few details. You need us to make slides for you, we'll be happy to help you or make them for you and send them to you for review before you present them. So just send us some details to suggestionbox@opcug.ca. Hope everybody enjoyed the material we had tonight. Pretty diverse bunch of stuff, lots of interesting discussion. And I hope we'll see you all next week.
Many thanks to those who contributed tonight and those who showed up to learn some more.